The Guardian.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the renowned website builder that helps you share your story with the world in the most beautiful way. Establish a personal brand, portfolio, or e-commerce store at squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
And welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Nicola Davis. Coming up on the show, what will happen to human skill and sensibility as automation continues to transform our lives? As more of our routine tasks become the province of machines, what jobs will we prioritise instead? And does radical automation suggest a new leisure age is around the corner? Plus, why is the impact of climate change on the remote islands of the Pacific not turning out as we would expect? This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. FutureFest is a weekend of immersive experiences, performances and speakers designed to excite and challenge perceptions of the future. The festival is happening in London on the 14th and 15th of March, and this week we're focusing on an event called Toast in the Machine, the fate of human skill and sensibility under radical automation. Three of the event's panellists join me now. Down the line from the University of Oxford is Associate Professor in Machine Learning, Mike Osborne. In the studio, we have Ghislaine Boddington, Creative Director of Body Data Space. She's linked to the University of Middlesex. And Anna Dimitriou, Artist in Residence in the Department of Computer Science at the University of Hertfordshire. Welcome to you all. Michael, in your recent work, you've analysed how machine learning could lead to computer programs that can carry out tasks better than humans can do them. Before we talk about whether that means we'll get replaced by a robot, perhaps you can start by explaining what we mean by machine learning in the context of artificial intelligence and automation.
Right, so I would define machine learning as the study of algorithms, that is, in particular, pieces of software code that can think, learn, and act in the same way that we might traditionally have thought the preserve of humans, that is, to kind of reproduce many of the quintessentially human activities within software.
Is this sort of widespread already? I mean, do we use this without really realising it? Because it sounds sort of being pitched as sort of a big threat to our current jobs, but are we already using machine learning?
We absolutely are. So in our everyday interactions on the internet, we're quite likely to be interacting with algorithms if we're being recommended products through Amazon, if we're having photos automatically identified by Facebook. In many different ways, algorithms are already very intrusive in our lives.
In some of your work, you've estimated that in the next 10 to 20 years or so, around 35% of jobs in the UK are at risk from automation. Can you tell me a bit about that? You know, what sort of jobs are we talking about? And when you say at risk, do you mean that computers are just going to replace humans?
Right. So to put a caveat on that figure, it's important to note that what we're actually predicting is the technological capability of algorithms and robots within the next 20 years or so. So we're certainly not saying that these jobs will be replaced, which will obviously be dependent on a whole host of other factors. We're simply saying that we predict that there will exist the technology to potentially do so. So to kind of highlight some examples where we see algorithms and robots increasingly having impact on human employment, we highlight the examples of mobile robotics in particular, so self-driving vehicles, as being enormously impactful for logistics occupations. So here we're thinking about people such as forklift drivers, potentially taxi drivers, certainly agricultural vehicle drivers or mining vehicle drivers, where it's very possible to introduce an algorithm that can drive that vehicle perhaps even better than a human can, that's perhaps even more aware of its surroundings, perhaps even more vigilant on the roads than a human might be able to be. In a similar way, we're going to see the intrusion of algorithms into any other occupation that requires storing, processing, and accessing data. So here I'm thinking about occupations including tax preparation, insurance appraisal, and certainly other occupations such as telemarketers where there might be information relating to the kind of responses that might be appropriate to various circumstances presented to them.
What about jobs that require creative thinking or manual dexterity? I mean, how do they fare? I heard that it took a robot at Berkeley 25 minutes to fold a towel or something. Right. So should we be worried about this?
Right. So in fact, those two things you've identified formed two of our three bottlenecks to computerization. So just to repeat, our bottlenecks to computerization, the kinds of characteristics of jobs that are not going to be readily replaced by machines in the near future, were social intelligence, creativity, and the requirement to interact with complex objects in unstructured environments.
Mm-hmm.
So all three of those bottlenecks, to some extent, require sort of deep, intuitive, tacit knowledge that humans have, but that is not necessarily easy to reproduce in code. It's very difficult for us to extract that information from our heads and to place it into a machine.
There are computers like IBM's Watson that are being used to help medical diagnosis. Surely that's sort of more of a help than a case of just replacing doctors, it's just an aid. Is there a role for computers and for algorithms to simply enhance our own abilities?
Oh, absolutely. So I think something we'll certainly see in the future is that more and more human work will be devoted to one of those three bottlenecks. So I can see human jobs becoming more creative and more social as a consequence of the other tasks within a job being handed off to an algorithm to perform the more routine information processing. So I think Watson is an excellent example where it might actually complement existing medical professionals by sort of taking away the difficulty of digging through case files and processing that information in such a way as to make a clinical recommendation to a particular patient in front of a doctor. The doctor can then have more time to respond to the kind of emotional needs of the patient.
Is there an argument to say that even if an algorithm could do a job better than humans, is there an argument to say that perhaps people would prefer to interact with a human regardless?
I think there is certainly an argument that humans in many cases would prefer to interact with humans, but I think it's also possible that could be overstated. So as one pertinent example, in our original study from 2013, we'd highlighted waiters and waitresses as being relatively non-automatable. We'd included waiters and waitresses in our training set as an example of an occupation that could not be computerized within the next 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
But our algorithm actually came back to us and returned a probability of computerization for those occupations that was about 0.9, if I remember correctly, actually quite a high figure. We were a bit surprised by that because we thought that the social requirements of those kinds of roles would indeed sort of prevent it from being computerized. But subsequent to the study being published, we've seen restaurants such as Applebee's in the US essentially replacing waiters and waitresses by putting tablet computers on each of the tables in the restaurant. And I think what we're realizing there is that actually in many cases people don't need as much social interaction as the traditional human employees might have been delivering. That even if this tablet can't do everything that a human waiter or waitress might do, certainly in the sphere of social interaction, it might be able to do enough to nonetheless replace those jobs.
Anna, you've been doing some work around these sort of interactions between people and machines and how people feel about interacting with machines. Can you tell me a little bit about how you feel about this idea about replacing social interactions with computerized machines and algorithms?
What we've been working with at Hertfordshire University is looking at robots as companions or even carers for older people. And it's interesting because there's sort of a gap between what some people want and what other people want. So younger people will say, oh, no, that would be a terrible thing. Why can't we just get more people to look after them? People should be responsible. Older people are generally quite positive about it because they think, well, actually, you know, I don't necessarily want a stranger coming in my home. I still want privacy. So, like, if it's just a machine, they sort of prefer that in a way. And also with our robot Harry, which is humanoid art research robot one, we've done some like events with older people, and they said that actually if they were feeling sad and Harry kind of put their arm around them or something, because we did some experiments, artistic experiments, not scientific experiments, where we invited people to kind of have their photo taken with a robot when they were standing next to the robot. We did it so that the robot would reach out and put its arm around the person, which is something that never happens, that robots don't tend to touch or caress or anything like that. So our robot's constantly moving and constantly kind of in flux, and people give it a wide berth sometimes. They give it personal space, and we play with those sorts of interactions. But we had a very positive response from when we had this event with older people discussing this issue. And what was also fascinating was the first question that came up was, these carer robots are all very well. I heard there are sex robots available. What about those? That's what we were asked.
Michael, if machines displace workers from one area of a workforce, particularly in some of those areas that you were talking about earlier, Are there new areas that are going to open up? I mean, you said that we might become more creative, but are there whole new kinds of areas of employment that might develop for us?
Right, so I think that's absolutely true. And in fact, we've seen in the recent past a number of new industries generated that I don't think any of us would have foreseen even 10 to 15 years ago as a result of new technologies. So I'm thinking about some of the occupations that appear on LinkedIn's list of fastest growing occupations such as iOS developers, mm-hmm. Android developers, social media interns. So I think what unites those new occupations is exactly one or more of those bottlenecks that I identified earlier. So I think to be an effective software developer, you certainly do need to have some degree of creativity in how you develop that code and how it feels and responds to users' interactions. And I think certainly to be a social media intern, you need to have a very deep understanding of social nuances and the culture in which we find ourselves. But I think the alarming thing is that actually the number of the jobs that we've seen generated through these technologies is not very large. So my economist collaborator, Carl Benedict Frey of the Oxford Martin School, has recently done some work and found that only about 0.5% of jobs in the US are in industries that didn't exist at the beginning of the 20th century. So in the last 15 years, we've only been able to generate 0.5% of jobs in those industries. And I don't think that's going to be very surprising to many people. If we think about the kinds of new companies we've seen emerge over the last few years, of which I think something like WhatsApp is perhaps the most emblematic example. WhatsApp, at the time it was acquired by Facebook, had about 55 employees when it was bought out for about 19 billion US. So, you know, we're really not seeing a lot of employment growth in these industries. And in particular, the employment that we are seeing being generated is relatively high skilled. So I think we do have some questions left to answer as we look ahead to the workforce of tomorrow.
Are people right to feel sort of threatened by machines, by technology? I mean, is that something that is actually a valid concern? Is that what you're saying?
It's difficult to say. I mean, there are many factors, as I pointed out before, that will influence whether or not there is unemployment as a result of these developments. Obviously, there will be new jobs that are created. The consumer surplus that is delivered by these technologies, the kind of increasingly cheap and amazing technologies that are delivered, I don't think we should neglect. I think our standard of living will be improved enormously as consumers by all these new developments. But nonetheless, I think it is something to keep an eye on to make sure that we do have appropriate policy responses in place to ensure that really everybody can share in the enormous wealth generated by these technologies.
Geelan, you've been involved in several projects that explore the interactions between humans and robots. Do we distrust robots, or are we drawn to them, or how do we interact? Do we see them as sort of objects of fear?
No, I don't think so. I think in the main, people are aware how many little different kinds of robots are around us. And actually, at FutureFest, there's a film called Robot World showing, which is sampling thousands and thousands of robots across all sectors of work. It's amazing how many are around us all the time. It's an interesting one because I think the uncanny valley metaphor that we always use is where the scare line is. Mm-hmm. It's a constantly moving scenario. So the valley's moving all the time. I remember looking back about 15 years ago or so, there was a absolute amazement at the robot toys coming out, the dogs, and actually, you know, the imagination pushes, as it does within sci-fi movies, that push our imagination towards the dystopias that can come through. But actually today, those things are quite normal. And actually, I think most people know there's an on-off button too.
One of the projects you've commissioned, The Blind Robot, will feature at FutureFest. Can you tell me a bit about what that's all about?
Yes, this is a project that was one of several works commissioned for a large-scale EU programme called Robots and Avatars. Mm-hmm. And Robots and Avatars was started through the Nesta support system, but we took it to look at how we are representing ourselves, our living human bodies, into digital worlds through bodily representations such as robots and avatars in virtual worlds. And Blind Robot was one of the commissions. It's by an artist called Louis-Philippe Demers, who's quite a well-known robotic artist internationally. And he's very particularly looking at that social interface which is potentially still the other side of the uncanny valley for us all, which is the touch of a robot. So the blind robot, actually, you choose to sit in front of it, if you choose to do so, or you can watch. If a blind robot puts his hands out and he gently feels your face, as does a visually impaired person, when they're learning about you and learning to be familiar with you. Mm-hmm. And the feel touch side, we've been really exploring in the FutureFest concept, actually, that particular line on the Uncanny Valley. How do we deal with machine touch? And that takes us straight into the areas of healthcare, the use of robotics and robots in hospitals, which is quite large, I believe, in Japan and various places, and more so in the UK too. Lifting robots, robots that care within the home and within domestic situations. Again, in Japan, I think there's 20 companies plus that are making care robots for in the home, and that are becoming more companions in a way, like Anna just put forward with her own work, looking at My Robot Companion, which will also show in FutureFest. Because they are in bodily form, how do we react to them? How do we actually start to relate to this body representation, which does have an on-off button? And actually, when we're not observing it, is it a robot or is it just a machine?
Many of the jobs that Michael had sort of talked about there are not necessarily going to be done by machines that look like humans. But is it important when it comes to a care setting, Anna, that your robot does actually in some way look humanoid?
Probably not, no. I think people just have a fascination for humanoid robots. I mean, I was fascinated. I was working a lot at Sussex University before, and very simple evolutionary robotics type systems where they're looking at things like how does a nematode worm and its neurons, 302 neurons interact or something. And that's all very fascinating. But then when I was put in touch with Hertfordshire University's work and they were working with humans, I thought there was a really interesting area for me as an artist to kind of intervene in that. And I think people are obsessed with this idea of creating a living thing that looks like a human, from dolls to Pinocchio, got Coppelia and the ballet, all those types of things. And myself and the other artists of the work, Alex May, we wanted to kind of just really play with and investigate those kind of feelings in this piece, really, I think.
Anna, I was just going to ask you then, actually, Gillian, perhaps you can come in on this too, is obviously there are many professions or jobs or situations where machines and robots could actually help us quite dramatically. In exploring how we sort of relate to machines and how we feel about them, as you have, is there anything that we can do to make people feel more comfortable with the sort of introduction of technology into their working lives?
I think the more we are relating to machines, robots, whatever, through our natural interfaces of the body, the easier it is. So we don't have to learn new ways. We are good living bodies that have evolved in certain ways. We're not perfect, but we do have our fingers to use, our, you know, gesture use, etc., which is quite natural for us. And I think the symbiosis and the relativity of us to a machine, whether it's a human-like looking robot machine or not, yeah, is enabled if we can make it more complementary to the skin, to the inside of the body. There's a whole area of looking at implants in the future. We're looking ahead here, but where potentially very small implants into our hands or wrists will actually control the machines around us. So it's about creating a figure of eight in a conversation which is flows in our daily life and complements us and doesn't make life harder.
This idea of the uncanny valley, it's a bit of a funny thing, and we were talking about the sort of moving target of it, and there's a lot of debate over whether it even exists or not, or whether it's just this nice narrative that we've all kind of hooked something on. But when people do say they feel this sort of feeling of discomfort or kind of a little bit kind of horrified when they first kind of encounter a robot or a humanoid robot particularly, that really goes really quickly. In a few hours, you get quite used to it. It's just literally exposure to more humanoid robots in the world will get us more used to them, make us happy. People seem to love them, actually. That's the weird thing. Is like, I really don't think that there's going to be a huge like horror about humanoid robots. It's probably more related to the software side, the app side, the algorithms that are kind of intervening in our lives in sort of unseen ways, these sort of obvious, there, tangible, embodied physical robots aren't necessarily the thing that's going to most upset us.
Mike, do you fear that there might be some sort of backlash against the kind of onward creep of technology, machine learning and automation into the workplace?
There certainly might be, but I think one thing to keep in mind is that as these algorithms are able to gather more and more data about us, they'll be able to tailor themselves to be more and more familiar to us as we're able to record more and more of our interactions online and provide those interactions to algorithms to learn from. I think they'll be able to present themselves in ways that become more and more human-like, more and more familiar to us. So while there might be some initial backlash and reaction to how the algorithms and robots interact with us, I think in the long term, as they just gather more and more data about human behavior, they'll be able to actually become, you know, a reasonable substitute for human interaction.
Obviously, one of the big questions a lot of people will have is the idea, well, some of the ethical ideas really surrounding the introduction of these technologies into the workplace, which is, you know, what happens if something goes wrong? Who takes the blame? Where does that buck stop? Are these issues which are sort of being ironed out at the moment, Mike?
Right. So this is obviously an ongoing discussion, particularly when it comes to technologies such as autonomous vehicles, to sort out the liability issue, you know, where responsibility is actually held in the event of an accident. But one thing to say there, of course, is that in many applications, and I think autonomous vehicles are one example, that safety of algorithms is actually going to be far superior to that of humans, in that, you know, this algorithm will be able to look both in front and behind of itself. It'll be alert 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and it might potentially further down the line be instrumented and wired up to other vehicles on the road in such a way that it might be able to automatically avoid them. So yes, there obviously is a very serious concern about how responsibility is held in the event of an accident, but I think in many cases we shouldn't overlook the fact that humans aren't that safe as the kind of state of the art, and algorithms might actually do a better job.
Anna, you've done some work on this. Are there big ethical conundrums that you can see?
Actually, I wanted to say that there's already a precedent in law for this. There are semi-autonomous vehicles that we all travel on all the time, aircraft. They're flown most of the time and sometimes landed by machines, algorithms. And so the legal precedent of responsibility has already kind of been mapped out in that. There's a difference on the insurance side. That's probably the biggest problem with things like autonomous vehicles or things like this. How do you insure them? And the data gathering is an issue, because if you want to have a humanoid robot in your home that's going to be a companion for you, it's going to know a lot about you. Maybe it's gathering data for use to market things to you as well. Maybe you don't want that. So there are some other interesting ethical implications too.
Gillen, we're often sort of sold a very negative idea of machines and of robots and what they can do. Why is that, or should we be concerned about that?
Yes, I think we are full of a world of negative ideas around the man-machine interface, and that's been for many centuries. Even, you know, if we look back to Frankenstein stories, and it's all part of the exploration that we need to do about the merge between the different parts of us that exist and the things that we make. And I think in some ways the exploration of those negatives and the dystopias that are often put to us, particularly through sci-fi films and multiple sci-fi films, the negatives, the dire consequences, the total wipeout of the human race that could happen, I sometimes wonder whether that actually isn't us getting all of those issues out of our system, a bit like when you dream and you have a nightmare and it takes the fears out of it. And I hope that actually those explorations would lead to the opposite in terms of the makers of the future, that they learn from those dystopias and they learn what not to do, and therefore how to actually make the positives come through for what could be a very complementary part of our lives and enhancing and helping us towards more possible leisure time.
Futurefest is happening in London on March 14th and 15th, and you can find out more at futurefest.org.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, a powerful platform that gives you simple tools to create a gorgeous website in minutes. With elegant templates, Getty image integration, and marketing tools, you can make your ideas resonate with the world. Try it at squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Now with the latest from the Science Desk this week, it's Ian Sample, Carl Matheson and Hannah Devlin.
Carl, you've been writing about the impact of climate change on the remote islands in the Pacific Ocean. Your piece this week revealed that we may not be facing the immediate loss of the land made up by these islands and atolls, but it's the loss of habitable land that's the important issue. And you were out there pretty recently, right?
Yeah, in December. It's a really complicated story, Ian. The climate change effect of sea level rise is impacting these places, but in a very subtle way. And it's on top of lots of climatic effects that are things like the ENSO cycle, El Nino. So it's very, very difficult to separate all these things out. But what we're seeing on the whole, because of sea level rise, is increased droughts, inundations, so flooding. When there's big tides and big waves, then you get these floods that come across the islands, and they're probably the thing that are really impacting people's lives at the moment.
And I suppose when people think of these islands, we're talking about the atolls and so on, people think they are, the issue they face is as simple as going underwater with sea level rises, something that they might think is a long time hence. But it sounds like it's not quite so much that.
That's a question that scientists are really only starting to come to grips with. The studies that have been done show that across the Pacific in the last 50 years, actually, there's a general trend of islands, of atolls getting bigger. They're not sure why that's happening. It's a very, as I said, it's a really complicated mix of factors. I think what we're seeing on the whole for these people with the impacts of climate change is not so much the loss and erosion of their islands as the floods coming in and poisoning the waterlands, killing their crops and making their lives really difficult. So that's what's making the lands more increasingly uninhabitable.
You use this phrase, the water lens. Is that the fresh water that's available through what? Do they have wells or?
Yeah, so when it rains, a little bit of fresh water filters through the sand and gathers about 2 or 3 metres below the surface. It's generally only a few metres thick. They plumb wells down to that, and that's where they get their water from on the whole.
What are those populations doing in response to this? Are they having to move out? Is there anywhere for them to go? Do they have a natural place to go?
The two major capitals of Kiribati and the Marshall Islands are incredibly overcrowded. There's really not much land for them to move to, and it's putting a lot of stress on the freshwater supply. People say that they could then spread out across the atolls. There's lots and lots of atolls in that region, but their access then to services and education becomes really difficult. And for the people of Kiribati especially, they have no access to visas. They can't move freely to other countries. The Marshall Islands, they have free association with the USA, so they can shift off and move as they like. It's not ideal for them, of course, because they're losing their land, and that's heartbreaking, but at least they have that option.
How do those people feel about that, though? I mean, they presumably, I don't know whether they feel people need to move within this generation, or whether they feel this is something for their children or their grandchildren to have to worry about. What is going on in their minds about this, the urgency of the need to move, and whether they really will or not?
It differs. The people that we spoke to, on the whole, were facing this as an immediate threat within their lifetimes, especially people that were either young adults or people that had young families who felt that they should make the move themselves for their children. I suppose people are working on about a 30-year time frame. And that's simply because there's been a few predictions made around by scientists that give them about that kind of time before the islands become uninhabitable. It's very, very difficult to say, though. On the whole, though, what we experienced from people was a real level of heartbreak about facing the loss of islands that they've inhabited, their people have inhabited for generations.
And is it changing what people kind of do? Are people going through education thinking, I need to get to a certain degree of education so I can be accepted as an immigrant elsewhere and things like that? Is that feeding into?
Absolutely. So the president of Kiribati, Anote Tong, he's been really specific about this. He said that we need to migrate with dignity. And so his emphasis has been on promoting programs that give people qualifications that mean that they can migrate because of their visa situation. One of the big pilot programs that's actually just been cancelled by the Australian government was training nurses, because we've got a big shortage of nurses in Australia, where I come from. they trained 80 or 90 young Kiribati people, which actually allows them to move. So it's definitely in people's minds that these are the, we need to learn the skills, we need to educate ourselves so we can leave our land, which is a really, really sad state of affairs.
Let's turn our attention to some of the other stories that have been around last week. Hannah, you wrote a piece about why the year 1610 could be considered the start of a new human epoch.
Yes, yeah, so this is a story. It's come from a group of geologists who are keen to call time on the current epoch that we're in and start a new one called the Anthropocene. The argument is that mankind has produced such dramatic, irreversible changes to the Earth that they're equivalent to the big geological events of the past. So talking about the end of ice ages, tectonic activity. And one of the authors of this new analysis, Simon Lewis, described humans' actions on Earth have been as earth-changing as a meteorite strike in the past in terms of the impact on geology, the Earth's chemistry, and the species on Earth. The difficult thing about it, even if you accept this view, is pinning down the exact moment of the transition. So when does the current epoch, the Holocene, end, and when might the Anthropocene begin? What geologists are really looking for is something called the golden spike, which is a series of changes that have happened universally across Earth and that are visible and measurable in some sort of permanent geological record. So things like ice cores or marine sediment that you'd be able to look back at in the future and spot the moment that the change happened. So that's what this is about. And the year 1610 has been identified as potentially one of the best candidates.
What happened in 1610 that was particularly sort of indicative of this human suddenly becoming the major force in shaping the Earth?
Funnily, nothing really happened in 1610 itself. 1610 was picked because it's the point in the carbon dioxide record from ice cores where you see a dip reaching its minimum. This dip in the CO2 was a kind of knock-on effect of the Europeans arriving in the New World, so the colonialists arriving in the Americas. So what happened when they arrived was they introduced all sorts of diseases, notably smallpox, and that wiped out about 50 million or so indigenous people, resulted in a huge reduction in farming in the whole sort of North American and South American continents. That produced such a degree of reforestation that you saw a dip in the CO2 levels across the Earth. So the argument is that this year, 1610, is when you would see that minimum if you were looking back through the ice core data at some point in the future.
Some people have argued for other dates like the beginning of the Industrial Revolution or the first sort of atomic test, which sent these sort of long-lived radionuclides around the whole world, and you could see those in the sediments and so on. Has he got much support for 1610, or are people still just arguing about when actually they want to have the Anthropocene begin?
Yesterday I spoke to the chair of a working group from the International Commission on Stratigraphy, which is the world body that makes decisions on when we go from one epoch to another. This scientist, Jan Salasevich, he argues that actually the nuclear record is a better point for the transition to occur. And he says that his working group are converging on this view that the mid-20th century is actually a better marker for the transition. What this will be looking at is the nuclear testing that occurred in the 1950s and then was suddenly phased out when the Test Ban Treaty came into force in the 1960s. And so you see a spike in the levels of nuclear isotopes if you look in any material across Earth in around 1964. So that's another strong contender. And it is one that was considered by this recent analysis, but they're favouring the 1610.
So there's a lot of discussion going on about what date to pick, but are there many people who say, you know, actually we don't need another epoch, that we're all fine with the Holocene?
There are definitely critics of this idea. I mean, there's people that say this is not really scientific and this is just really a desire to make a political statement about the extent of human destruction on the planet, and, you know, to say that we've made these changes that are so irreversible, it's quite a powerful statement. The other point that people make is that actually the Holocene has only been with us for about 11,000 years, and that's quite short for an epoch. Most of them are tens of millions of years long, so it seems as though we might be in a sort of epoch inflation situation.
Must be tough if you're a Holocene researcher as well, because you probably, you know, you're going to be outdated by a bunch of other geologists who say actually you're now working on stuff that was in the past rather than stuff that's current, and you're now actually a historian rather than a current geologist.
Yes, well, Simon Lewis, one of the people who led this analysis, he suggests that we should actually downgrade the Holocene and just make it a short stage of the previous epoch. We should just call what we're in now the Anthropocene.
I was writing about one of the moons of Saturn called Enceladus, which has been sort of growing in its sort of attractiveness to astrobiologists because there sort of seem to be increasing signs with every visiting probe and every measurement that it looks more and more habitable. The latest discovery being not only that there is what we knew before, that there was looked like to be some subsurface liquid water ocean, but that water has a heat source down at its core, which makes it potentially like the environment you see around hot vents at some ocean floors, where you have a really hot core warming up the water, which would give you these kind of valuable things if you want life, which would be energy, nutrients and liquid water there.
So these kind of places, they can sustain life without any access to sunlight?
One of the astrobiologists I spoke to said that the evidence building up for this under ice ocean on Enceladus, and this is a really tiny moon, it's only 300 miles across, it's one of the many moons that you've got around Saturn. He said, his name's Chris Mackay at NASA Ames Research Center in California, he said that this ocean is looking habitable. Doesn't mean it's inhabited, but it's looking habitable, which means that you've got these conditions. You've got the warmth, you've got the water, and you've got the minerals. So you can start having chemical reactions with these rocks. You can start running sort of biological processes off. You need to have some kind of in situ energy source because it's too far away from the sun to get any decent enough heat to warm it from the sun alone. So finding the heat source does make it more likely. Now, one of the questions about whether that life would have actually had a chance to evolve there, apart from whether you have the right sort of feedstocks, if you like, the right chemicals to begin with, is that there's no telling at the moment whether the warmth has been stable enough for long enough for life to come about. And there are some hints that the warmth and these cycles are pretty episodic. So it could be warm and then really frigid for a while and warm and then cold again. And with that kind of fluctuation, you may not get something coming along, and obviously even if it is habitable, it doesn't mean you necessarily get life wherever a place is habitable.
I was quite fascinated by how they discovered this ocean, because you've got this 300 mile wide moon, you've got a 25 mile thick crust of ice, it's however far Saturn is away from the Earth. How did they find what was underneath the crust?
So the discovery of the ocean was actually with some previous measurements taken from the same probe, which is called Cassini, and it looked at the gravitational field of the moon, and you can tell from that what is going on subsurface, and you can look for changes in the strength of the gravitational field, and you can tell that we haven't got ice all the way down. And when you look at the composition of the moon, you can get some good ideas. It's all helped by the fact that you get these really common, really regular sprays of steam and dust actually ejecting out of the moon, which they've also been able to see, and they're going to fly through again. They've flown through them already. This stuff is just spraying out from inside, and so that gave them hints that there was some kind of geological process going on underneath that was giving the energy to chuck this stuff out.
Normally when you've got planets or moons this far from the sun, my understanding is they're just cold dead rocks. What's going on inside that planet to make that heat?
So it's not entirely clear what is making the core hot. One of the scientists said to me, well, some of it may be residual radioactivity left over from sort of the creation of this moon, whatever, 4.5 billion years ago. But that's going to be pretty minimal, if at all, there. The main contender is tidal heating. So what this is all about is as the moon goes around, goes on its orbit, the forces on it change, which cause the moon to be sort of squeezed and then relaxed and squeezed and then relaxed. And you know, if you do this with a squash ball or a tennis ball, if you go like this with it in your hand, squeezing it, releasing it, it gradually warms up. And you get that from on a moon like this, you'll get that from just friction with the rock being squeezed. Now, the orbit of Enceladus around Saturn is pretty round, actually, and you would get more heating if it was a more eccentric orbit, because, you know, the forces would be that more dramatic. But it seems that the orbit is probably has enough of a sort of difference in it that it is not sort of quite circular enough that you are getting decent enough heating to at least give you some of that heat. It may not explain all of it, though. There's still some question marks over that.
So, Ian, are there any planned missions to actually land on the moon or get a bit closer and be able to tell a bit more about what might be under there?
There's nothing solid that's on the schedules of NASA or the European Space Agency or any other space AG for that matter. I mean, they're going to keep flying Cassini around it. They're going to start keep looking at these vapor plumes that are coming from Enceladus. But there are proposals, and I mean, there are always proposals to do all sorts of radical things in space. One of the interesting ones comes actually from Chris Mackay, the astrobiologist who's very excited about Enceladus, and for good reason. And he wants to basically have a mission that does flybys through these plumes that are coming out, but have them done by a probe that's equipped to look for biological signatures. So you may actually be looking for organics. You might actually be looking for differences in isotopes of components there, which would tell you that there's something interesting going on that might reflect a sort of biological process that might mean there's some kind of biological, some microbial life going on under the ocean. Whether there are Enceladus fish and things like that, maybe they wouldn't pick that. Maybe they get a waft of fish come out. Who knows? But long shot, I think.
And that's all we have for you this week. A big thank you to Guillaume Boddington, Mike Osborne, Anna Dimitriou and Carl Matheson. For me, Nicola Davis, and all the science team, thanks for listening.